Thanks, John. My name's Mari and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm just delighted to be here. My dry date is the 10th of August, 1984. My group is a Markham Village group in Markham, Ontario. I have a sponsor, an eye sponsor, and I'm an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would like to thank Jerry so much and Michelle, who's helped him so much, for putting this on. I mean, it looks like a really great format. And I'm looking forward to listening. And I would like to be sitting in the audience just listening. But that's not why I'm here. I'm not here for my good looks. Also, I'd like to thank Frankie. Are you here, Frankie? For picking me up at the airport. It's always exciting when somebody with 6 months picks you up at the airport. It is, yeah. And of course, a great treat is to be here with Bob and Clancy. I mean, that doesn't get any better than that for me. And I'd like to thank John for all the service you give. Thank you, John. You know, it says that we tell our stories in a general way, what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. And what we used to be like, what I used to be like, you know, the older I get, the better my long-term memory gets. And the worse my short-term memory gets. And I have been thinking a lot about that recently. You know, I went to Scotland like I usually do every year to see my family, and I go and I stay with my old aunt, who is the one who came and took me off the street in 1980. And this time we were just sitting looking at one another, and because she's always studying me, and she said to me, you know, we should have taken you to a psychiatrist when you were three. And I said, the last time I was here, you said it was when I was like 10. She said, but I've been thinking about it a lot. And I am continually amazed by the power of these steps, by the power of this program, by this wonderful God that I have found in AA, by the wonderful sponsorship I have, that because of what I have gone through in these 34 years of being in Alcoholics Anonymous, I truly have had a change of personality. Because from when I was very young, alcohol made me an extrovert, something I always wanted to be, but just couldn't make it. But the thing that sticks in my mind the most is how incredibly inferior I felt to everybody else. Always this feeling of being just different, just not enough. My self-esteem was nowhere. Now, I don't know why that was. I truly believe that that just came with the package. I had a good home. I had loving parents. But I just never, ever felt right. And I remember I was thinking about this too the other day, going around when I was young and looking at people's eyes and then to see if they would smile at me. Always judging my own self from how you reacted to me. Now I don't care. You know. I mean, I care about people deeply. I never used to care about anybody else. I care about people, I love people, I'm just very fortunate that I have this ability today to move around in the world. But you see, I just always felt different, felt less than, felt like I was on the outside looking in, just never ever felt enough. And because I never ever felt enough, I get into bad behavior. I seem to have been born with some kind of a criminal mindset. I don't know why, but if I steal and lie and cheat, it would make me feel a little better. If I would steal and lie and cheat, it would make me feel that I had an edge on you. And the only way I'm going to have an edge on you is to get one over you. So what I'm really saying is I just never, ever, ever felt right. And people told me I'm not right. People told me that. People always said to me, there's something seriously wrong with you. You know? So when I came in here and my first sponsor said to me, you know that there's more than alcohol, there's something. I said, I always knew there was something seriously wrong with me because people were always saying to me, there's something seriously wrong with you. But I did everything I could to try and fit in the world. And then I became, I decided that because I wasn't, I know what the turning point was today. The turning point for me was when I was 10 years old. My grandfather, who was my hero, died. My grandfather understood me because he was an alcoholic. Well, he was a weekend alcoholic. I remember every Friday and Saturday night, my old grandfather, my hero, would come staggering down the street, the way the drunk walks from east to west. And my granny would be behind the curtain with a rolling pin and a rosary. The two staples of the Irish household. And every Friday and Saturday night, there would be the only war there ever was in my home. And on a Sunday morning, when I used to walk up to church with my old grandfather, before we left home, I'd see him sitting holding his head in his hands. And I would say to him, what are you thinking about? And he'd say, I'm pondering the immensities. I'm pondering the immensities. And I was to ponder the immensities until I nearly disappeared into my navel, thinking about things. You know, there's a slogan, I don't know if you have it here, but we have it in Ontario. And it says, think, think, think. I tell my sponsees, you don't look at that. Or if you do look at it, you change it to action, action, action. Because I spent so much time dwelling on myself. One of the great things for me was when I came in here and I noticed that the bondage of self, relieve me from the bondage of self, was mentioned in our literature. Because I was utterly and totally consumed by self. Pathological degree filled with self. Sometimes people say to me, what is alcoholism if it's not just about drinking? And I try to tell them it's a strange personality disorder. That according to what I read about, it's manifested in obsession with self. And why was I was so obsessed with self? Because, you see, I was continually examining myself to think about the effect that I would have on you. And I was so wrapped up in myself that I was claustrophobic. And I don't even hear what you're saying to me. I would be looking at you and your lips would be moving, but I'm thinking about me, my favorite pastime. I never had decent sex. I've been married 4 times. Because I'm always thinking about myself. Right? It's just a phenomena with me. When you are that immersed in self, it is not a self-esteem. It's not because you think much of yourself. It's because everywhere you go, this pathological sense of self is telling you that when you walk into a room, everything's going to stop and they're going to look at you and say, there's something serious wrong with her. And I'm doomed before I've opened my mouth. I'm doomed. And I had a good education, you know. I certainly had a good education from the nuns. They were always trying to teach me everything that AA. They gave me a good education. They kicked me out at 15, rightly so. I got kicked out of the convent. And I learned so much before I was kicked out, though I'm very grateful to them. I learned out because one of them had the temerity to hit me. And I figured if she could give it, she could take it. And I do not know why I became so violent, but there was a period in my life, I know it doesn't look like it today, when I was violent because I could not find the words to protect myself. And I continually fell under attack. And where I come from, in Scotland, it's not exactly the city of brotherly love. There is a lot of religious bias. And I'm also a product of the Second World War. And I had a lot of rage and anger about that. My grandmother lost two sons, and she was always crying. And I had rage and anger about that, but she didn't. She had forgiveness. So even from a very early age, when it was not directed to me, I would find something to be angry about, something to be resentful about. So resentment was with me a long time before I ever came here, until I didn't care enough not to resent you anymore. And all of this was going into the mix for me. And then, of course, there's God. I was brought up in a good Roman Catholic home. But me and God started rowing away from God and the great sea of life when I was very young. First of all, because he took my grandfather. Then because of all the damage the war had done. Then because of how I felt. Then because of how I felt I was being mistreated. Now, when you lie, cheat, and steal, you shouldn't expect to be treated well. But to me, that was just part of who I was. And I did not deserve repercussions. I always thought I should have a free paper for everything I did. Not my fault. Not my fault. And my life was just a nightmare. There was something wrong with me, but I was self-will run riot. Broke my mother's heart. Ran away from home at 15. I hadn't had a drink yet. Checked myself into the Salvation Army. She came to get me. I threw her down the stairs. I hadn't had a drink yet. This behavior of mine, was it compensatory for something else? I don't know. But what I needed was a drink, but I did not know that. And every year my family would take me to Ireland, because I'm an Irish Scot. And they used to take me to a cathedral, and Bob's been there. He sent me a picture. And they used to sit me down in the front row. And then on the altar was the head of a martyred saint. He'd been burnt by the English, hung, drawn, quartered, and burnt. The English couldn't think of enough to do to this guy. But his burnt head is in a cage. It's been in there for a long, long time, hundreds of years. But he still has teeth. I mean, that just fascinated me, because teeth's a rare commodity where I come from. And they used to sit me in the front row. And they used to say, "Now, I want you to really sit and study St. Oliver Plunkett, because he really loved God." And I'm looking at this burnt head. I mean, really, I'm sitting there. They make me sit there and just look at this. And I was not doing well, because at that time I had a fear of death, you know. And I thought, the thought came to me. if that's an example of when you really love God, and that's what you get, I want more than that. I want more than that. And then, at an early age, I began to go away from God. And I believe that was part of my problem too. So I had this strange personality. Now, this personality that I have, I truly believe today it was a personality disorder. The only way to fix a personality disorder is a change of personality. But I was never taken to anybody who said she needs a change of personality. That happened to me a long time after, when I had gone down the road of darkness, humiliation, despair, self-disgust, lost my femininity, lost my humanity. Because I went so far down with alcohol that I never ever thought I would be able to live without it for a day. That is a horrendous dependence I had on alcohol. Nothing else. Alcohol. Because you see, the transformative qualities of alcohol and what it did for me was magic. Magic. What I did to try and get some ease and comfort in myself was I would change jobs because I wanted to have some self-esteem, because I wanted people to look up to me instead of thinking there's something wrong with you. Then I would get positions that had a uniform. So I went into nursing. Not a good career choice. I'm obsessed with death, I don't like blood, and I have panic attacks. And then I got fed up with that, as I do with everything. I never complete anything. Never complete anything I start. And then I go and start flying. Not a good career choice. Claustrophobic. And just generally neurotic. But what that uniform did for me was it snagged me a husband. A nice man. Cultured man. Wealthy man. I married a nice man, and he married a figment of my imagination. Because you see, I was going to be anything he wanted me to be, because I thought my last ditch attempt to try and feel like everybody else was to get married, to become utterly and completely dependent on that man for everything, because I have a dependent personality, and to have a child. Then I'll be all right. And at 25, I went to live in Kingston, Jamaica. You know, I'd taken geographics and I hadn't had a drink yet. Everywhere I went, I took myself along. You know, it says that we keep trying to change people, places, and things, but we never think about changing ourselves. And I'm in a foreign country and I have a baby and I have everything that money can get me. And I'm dying. And yet I love this child with every fiber of my being. What a conundrum. And then one day somebody says, have a drink. 25 years of age. Jamaica has 151 proof rum. Magic. Is it not? How beautiful is it? It is transformative. So it took a complete and utter wreck, a failure at life, somebody who'd done a lot of bad things without anything in my system, just me, who'd hurt a lot of people, by the time I was 25. I'd betrayed a lot of trusts. I'd stolen quite a bit of money. Living a bad life. And I think I'm going to go crazy and somebody gives me a drink. And I think it was a third glass of 151 proof rum, just little glasses. And everything was different. Alcohol changed my relation to the world. Alcohol gave me a change of personality. And all of a sudden, I go from being this self-conscious wreck who hates herself and who doesn't feel enough to thinking that I'm all right now. I'm good. And I like people. I used to hate people. Now I have a few drinks. Hi, how are you? Tell me your story. Let's get married. What's your name? The world takes on an entirely different hue and color for me. The world becomes a colored world, a beautiful colored world. Instead of the gray and white of the Glasgow that I used to be walking around in, which isn't really gray and white. London was not really gray and white, but that's all it ever was for me. Now I'm living in a colored universe. And I have the one thing I have been searching for all my life, the thing that's going to make me feel okay. The thing that's going to make me feel good. And it will never let me down. How can it ever let me down? It can't. Because every time I take a little bit of that, I feel good. I feel good. And I remember what it was like. They used to say to me, you can't drink before noon. That's what we do here. We have a drink at noon. And I remember the enormous anticipation. It's better than... Oh, I won't get into that, but it's better than... you know, it's better than that anticipation for anything else. Because that's not going to let me down. That I know that if I take that one, two, three sips, everything's good. But what happens is I can no longer hang in till noon. Because now I'm beginning to be dependent on it, and I don't know that. I'm baffled by that. I don't know that. I know in my heart it's not good for me to be sneaking a drink at 10 o'clock in the morning. But that's what I have to do now. And I can't go and tell anybody that. And I have a little boy that I love, and yet alcohol, that I love more than anything in the world, yet alcohol has such a strange grasp on me. And then I start drinking at night and getting up in the night to drink. And when my husband and my son have gone to bed, I'm sitting drinking till 3 a.m. And I'm now an alcoholic. And nobody ever told me that would happen to me. And it is the worst, most horrible dependence in the world. And eventually what happened with me is I burned all my bridges. I burned all my bridges in Jamaica. And I wasn't interested in anything but alcohol. And it's a small community where I come from, the community I was mixing in. The wealthy community. And I remember one time they said one of them was going to have a big pool party and they were going to show a movie. And they invited me. And they were showing The Days of Wine and Roses. And I got so angry with them that I turned over the table of drinks and created havoc. Because they were trying to tell me something and I didn't want to hear. And some of these other people used to come and say to me, Mary, come try a little sensimilia. Come have a little ganja. Look how the liquor's making your eyes red. And I used to say, I don't want nothing that's going to screw up my brain. I'll stick to liquor. Thank you. And then I had my other little boy, and I was drinking every day. I carried that child because I had lost the power of choice in drink. And I don't remember quite a bit then. But the sad and dreadful thing is that I took my sons out of Jamaica, just me, as a chronic alcoholic. And they were 9 and 5. And I took them on a journey with alcoholism, and they never touched a drop. They got a front row seat with this mother, the only adult they had in Canada, who loved them, who never physically abused them, but who is a slave to alcohol. And I didn't mean to be like that. But I had reached a place where I was beyond human aid. Because I was put in detoxes, I was put in psychiatric institutions, I was locked up occasionally. None of it helped. And after 2 years of living in Canada, I went back to Jamaica, and the children's father took him away from me. And so he should. Now, it took me a long, long time, even in AA, to say he did the right thing. Because I just hated him so much for taking my children. But he did the right thing. Because my son told him that one day mommy's going to kill my brother and me driving with us drunk in the car. And that sometimes mommy goes out and doesn't come back. And I don't mean to do that. I mean to go out for a drink. But you see, I don't know, I have the phenomena of craving. And, you know, I've told this story many, many times, many times. But somebody said to me, would you tell that story? And when I was in Jamaica, I had a BMW. And Bob Marley lived across the road. And he had a BMW. And I didn't like Bob. I didn't like Bob because he was a pothead. And he didn't like me because I was a drunk. And alcohol is against the Rastafarian religion. And one day he's in Mullen's garage with his BMW, and I come in with mine. And I'm standing outside waiting for them to fill up my car with my Dunhill cigarette lighter, swaying in the breeze, thinking about myself. And Bob drives up with his car, his BMW, and he shouts at me. And he said, see you? You're a hedonist and a narcissist, and you don't care about anybody but yourself. He took my inventory. And he was right. He said, you think you're so smart? I said, I'm known to have some intellect. He said, if you think you're so smart, what does BMW stand for? I said, Bavarian Motor Works. He says, no, man, it means Bob Marley and the Wailers. Hedonist and a narcissist, and you don't care about anybody but yourself. That just about described me. And I'll just tell you that after they took my children, I really wanted to die more than anything in the world, because I knew I was hopeless. I knew I couldn't live without my children. My heart cracked when he took away my children, and it's never healed. There are some things that are too deep to even describe. There are some despairs and some losses that are too deep to find the words for. There are some things that are just too deep for tears, even. Too deep for tears. And I remember drinking, I had 2 bottles of rum and 2 bottles of 150, I had 2 bottles of 151 proof rum, 2 bottles of Valium. And I remember taking it and sliding down and thinking, sweet oblivion. But I didn't die. Alcoholics don't die easy. When people say to me, Mary, I know if I drink again, I'll be dead. I say, you wish. Some of us live forever drinking. And they pumped out my stomach. And eventually I had to leave the island because it certainly did not stop me from drinking. And I went to Miami to drink myself to death. I wanted to drink myself to death, and I wanted to be in a place where I didn't know anybody. You know, it's so funny, and we talk about wanting to die. And we really do. The despair is so massive. The despair is so overwhelming. We're so baffled by this horrible condition that nobody understands. And everybody thinks it's because you're no good. You don't have any willpower. People used to say to me, Mary, why don't you just have one? I don't know, I have the phenomenon of craving. So when everybody's looking at you with this disgust, and you know you can't stop drinking, then the only thing is to take yourself to a place where nobody will find you and concentrate on drinking yourself to death. Now, I thought about jumping out a window or jumping off a balcony, but I didn't want to hurt myself. but that's the truth, you know. You know, if you're paralyzed, you can't drink. But you know, as much as I gave every effort I could not drink myself to death. I got alcohol poisoning. I got all of that stuff. But I could not drink myself to death. And in the end, I'd leave my door open because I'm a woman. I don't know anybody. I'm in an apartment complex. I'd leave my door open. I'm a chronic alcoholic. People would come in and take my furniture and take my jewelry and take my clothes, take my furniture, take me. And the despair was beyond description. You know, I read Bill's story, and quicksand all around. And that just doesn't cut it, really. Quicksand all around, you're going to go down and you're going to die. I didn't seem able to die. And I got kicked out of the apartment and ended up living on the street at the bottom of Lincoln Road on Miami Beach. And again, I don't need to go into that story, but that's what destroyed my last vestiges of humanity. And then my family found me. I have a very loving family. And I had panhandled off an old woman that used to live in Jamaica, and she now lived in Fort Lauderdale. And my family had met her when they used to come to Jamaica, so she told them where I was. And they came and got me. And then I ended up back in Canada. And I was treated as a manic depressive for 4 years in the institutions. I love being in the mental institution. I love it. They give me lithium, Valium, Librium, all the lovely yum-yums. And I get oblivion, compliments to the government. And I'm safe. I'm safe. I'm safe from the greatest enemy I have, which is me. And they used to send us to AA meetings. And I remember going, and the people who came told me afterwards, they used to say to me, Mary, do you have hope? And I used to say, I have no hope. But something must have stuck. And I remember one night, I just got out of the institution, and I was sitting, and I was drinking myself sober. Anybody ever been there? What a nightmare, eh? What a nightmare. And something said, pick up the phone, phone AA, because somebody had given me the number. And I called, and a man called Stan came, who had 28 years sobriety. He was a Métis, which is a French Native American, and he spoke to my heart. I was 40 years old, and nobody had ever spoken about the way I felt that I've just described to you from when I was a child. We are totally different in every area of our lives, and he's explaining to me what he used to be like. And that's what I used to be like. And he's telling me what happened. And I'm listening to that. And then he's telling me what it's like now. That he has a life of meaning and purpose. That he hasn't wanted to drink for 28 years. That he had been on the street. And I got great hope from that. Great hope. And eventually I found the third step prayer. And something happened to me in the saying of that, and I haven't wanted a drink since the 10th of August, 1984. Now, I don't understand that. I can't explain it to you. All I can say to you is something happened. I believe it was God. I believe that in a moment of utter and complete despair and hopelessness and agony, I cried out to God. And God loves the weak and the destitute. And I think that's what broke me. I don't know how much despair it takes to break the human spirit. I wish we could put that under a microscope. But something happened that broke my spirit. And I no longer wanted to fill that hole with spirit. I wanted to fill it with what you were giving me. A spiritual program of action. And I got into AA, and I had great sponsorship from the very beginning. I did a fourth and a fifth very quickly, and I got really immersed in the program. And I'll share this with you. The old timers used to say, Mary, we usually say no relationships for a year, but for you it's two. Because you have a propensity for getting married. So I'm 2 years sober, I'm now living in Toronto. I go into a meeting one day and I look down the table and I saw him. And I just knew that God had sent me my reward. Now people in Toronto used to say I was big, they used to call me Big Book Mary, and they said crazy, but I could quote Bill, and I loved AA, and I was going every day, but I was still a little not right. So at 2 years sobriety, I attract a man who, if he's attracted to me, he's not right either, okay? At least that's according to my sponsor. John and I would still go to a lot of meetings, and someone would ask me to read How It Works, and my eyes would flit across the crowded room, and I would see him, you know, looking at me with those big spiritual eyes. It's really psychosis, but it's and I used to have a beautiful vision of John and I walking off into the sunset under the circle and the triangle with Bill and Bob just behind it and Cal Young a little bit to the side. And I shared this with my sponsor, who had no romance in her soul. So I described the vision, and she said to me, with all her 40 odd years of sobriety, don't get married, you're an emotional retard. I and I knew she was jealous. So John and I eloped. We went to Melbourne, Florida. We got married in Melbourne. And here's what happens. In the close intimacy of marriage and relationship, if you haven't had what it describes in Appendix 2 as a change of personality, then all the same old stuff is going to come up when you're living in that close proximity with somebody. And I had to leave him in the end after a couple of years and start all over again. But we remained friends, and I was able to, when he had a stroke, I was able to take him home and look after him. He had a massive stroke, and I was able to take him home and look after him. My mother and father were both dead when I came here, but I was able to make amends in the way that was described to me. I have one brother, and I go and see him every year. My two sons came back to me when they were 13 years. Never, ever give up on your children. Love is the strongest thing there is. I certainly know it's God's love why I'm here. But the mother love and the father love you have for your children. I never thought my children would come back to me. But the old timer said to me, you might never get your family back, but you'll have a family here. And I've certainly found that to be true. So the great miracles that have happened in Alcoholics for, I don't deserve them. I don't want what I deserve, thank you very much. But I have had some, all because I've taken instruction, and that was one of the things that was told to me when you come in. Take the cotton batten out your ears and stuff it in your mouth. You can't talk for a year because you don't know nothing. Your best thinking got you to Alcoholics Anonymous. You've got to be teachable. You've got to be able to take instruction. And you've got to have structure in your life. And I was able to follow because I had a desire. I wanted this so bad. And my life today is I've got 5 little grandchildren. They love me. They love me. My two sons love me very deeply. They WhatsApp me every day. They said, Mommy, you still have a problem. You don't have a filter. But I'm working on it, and my life is one of purpose and meaning and gratitude. I thank God for AA, I thank God for Bill and Bob, because a hopeless alcoholic of my type, and I think of all the person who's gone before me, all the people who've died, wondering, what the hell's wrong with me? Why can't I stop drinking? And yet because of Bill and Bob, I've been given this. And thank you so much for having me.